Well, we're going to undertake two sessions to try to review our current horizon. And, of course, we're calling this series of presentations Red Sky in the Morning. We're taking that, of course, from the ancient seaman's proverb, Red Sky at Night, Sailor's Delight. Red Sky at Morning, Sailor Take Warning. When I was at the Naval Academy, I remember picking up on that ancient seaman's proverb. And it does happen to have some validity in terms of being able to predict the weather. But I was startled to realize it was an ancient proverb, even the days of our Lord, because he quotes it to the Pharisees and Sadducees. And then he says, oh, ye hypocrites, you can discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. And in fact, I would call the time in which we're living the other way around. It's the times of the signs. And we want to take a look at that. We're going to talk about the strategic trends that are confronting us in the year 2002. Now, whenever we take on a subject like this, one of the most useful things we can do is try to shed the baggage of our presuppositions, the myopia that we tend to bring to a task like this. One of the most important things in life are perspectives. The details you can find out by asking the right questions, but the precious thing, whether you're a businessman, planning markets or other decisions or whatever, is having a valid perspective of the market, of the near horizon, in fact, of life itself. And so perspectives are the precious things. But we tend to bring to the task the errors of our presuppositions. The most common one is linearity. We tend to just presume that tomorrow will be like yesterday, next week like last week, next month like last month, maybe next year pretty much like last year. We bring to the enterprise a presumption of linearity, that things will continue as they have been. And when we make charts or data, we often extrapolate linearly. And it is accurate so often that we rely on it too much and ignore the fact that life is full of what a mathematician would call non-linearities. And there are all kinds of those in every sector. We're going to talk a little bit about them. We'll also talk about the strange phenomenon of exponentiation. But then we'll set aside those broad issues and focus on specific strategic trends that are on our immediate horizon. Now, our nonlinear universe, you know, we have natural nonlinearities, be they earthquakes or tornadoes, things that happen that totally disrupt lives. Unpredicted, yet you never know what a day brings. Those are natural nonlinearities. You have political nonlinearities. You have the Berlin Wall came down, the Soviet Union dissolved, and so forth. You have financial nonlinearities, currency adjustments. The market goes down. You get fired, or your wife visits the mall. These are all financial nonlinearities. And, of course, there's cosmic nonlinearities when meteors hit planets and that sort of thing. There are also personal nonlinearities, and all of us have events occur in our life that are unpredictable on the one hand, and yet they are predictable. And we all can make lists of nonlinearities that will come along. Let's talk about another phenomenon that, unless you've studied these kinds of projections, you may never have encountered exponentiation. Fold a piece of paper in half. Okay, how many of you could do that? No problem, right? Do it 40 times. Fold it in half 40 times. How thick will it be? You say, gee, I've never done that, but it doesn't sound like it much. It would actually reach from here to the moon. See, every time you fold it, it doubles. When it's small, it doesn't amount to much, but it keeps doubling every time you fold it. Do it 40 times, and you've reached the moon. Do it double it another 40 times, and it'll go halfway across our galaxy. And double it another 20 times, and it'll go to the far limit of the universe. Exponentiation, the increase of the increase, if you will. Now, let's take this. We could go through a whole bunch of statistics. Healthcare expenditures became very nonlinear in the last few decades, going very, very high. The federal debt is another one that's going absolutely out of scale. It really shocks you when you start trying to plot this against any kind of a scale to realize how far and how rapidly it's continuing to increase. Air miles traveled, same thing. The gross domestic product in the U.S., the volume of advertising, the total mail, service and email, just going out of sight. Any attempt to put measures on our society, on our economy, are wild. And, of course, world population is the classic of them all. The amount of power in a single detonation, the weapons technology, is just increased. The economies of scale is staggering. And data transfer in wartime, obviously, has gone up tremendously. The defendable area per soldier, almost any parameter you take in the medical field, the economic field, the technology field, is just increasing incredibly. This, of course, has led, this kind of phenomenology has led to a whole series of study. Ehrlich's study back in 1968, population was left unchecked for 900 years. There'd be an enormous number of people that caused a lot of alarms. In the early 70s, Dennis Meadows from the Club of Rome, The Limits to Growth, pointing out there are physical limits to growth, and we may reach those in less than a century. Jay Forrester's Industrial Dynamics points out that nothing in the finite world can endure exponential growth onto infinity. There's a point at which it'll come apart. And we could go on and on. There's all these different studies that have contributed. Herman Kahn, I knew Herman Kahn. He's the classic think tank guy with the Hudson Institute. Exponentiation is limited by saturation effects, but what those saturation effects are is in itself unpredictable. And we go on. But rather than go through academic kinds of exercise and review all that, what we're rather going to do is take some specific trends that we can identify and monitor that we can impact, that we can see impacting our lives, which, incidentally, every one of them is discussed in the scripture. We'll talk about the proliferation of weapons, the rise of Islam, the struggle for Jerusalem, the Magog invasion, the rise of a European superstate, the rise of China as a superpower. We'll talk about biotech and pestilence in those areas. We'll talk a little bit about ecumenical religion, the move towards a global government, and, of course, we'll climax with the challenge that all these bring to America. So that's our task in this briefing. Let's start with weapons proliferation. This is the cloud that hangs over every geopolitical decision on the planet Earth. And we're going to take a look at a few of these things. George Tenet, the director of our Central Intelligence Agency, has said the probability that a missile armed with a WMD, that means a weapon of mass destruction, that would be used against U.S. forces or interests, is higher today than during most of the Cold War, and it will continue to grow. That's his assessment. Here's a professional. The paradigm of the past was relatively easy to grasp. Its dominant feature, there were two superpowers locked in a confrontation with clear limits and well-understood rules. Today, there are fewer rules and fewer people willing to play by them. And the constant march of technology threatens to break new paradigms even before they take shape. And this is out of the National Intelligence Council briefing that he gave on the trends between now and 2015. Nuclear-capable countries, there used to be just two, and it was a standoff, and a stalemate, a balance. Today, there's over a dozen countries that are nuclear-capable, either already or will be within a few years. And on this list, of course, with U.S., Russia, France, Germany, Great Britain, Israel, China, India, Pakistan, of course. But then you have Iran, Argentina, Brazil, South Africa, North Korea, Libya, and Iraq coming right behind it. So suddenly we're living in a multi-nuclear world. Now, the delivery capabilities, over 27 countries are developing advanced ballistic missiles. There are over 66 countries that have the technology for surface-skimming cruise missiles. Any country that can build a jet aircraft can build a cruise missile. And General Alexander Lebed, the popular Russian general that visited the United States a few years ago, said on camera, national television, he said, of the 132 suitcase nukes they've built, 84 are missing from inventory. They don't know where they are. It's a speculation that some of them are in terrorist hands in the U.S. Well, this technology that hangs over us was predicted by our Lord. In Matthew 24, verse 22, Jesus said, "Except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened." There will be a group of people that for their sake, those days will be shortened. You know, this prediction by Jesus probably didn't have much impact on us if we were reviewing that, say, during the middle of the 19th century, say, during the time of the Civil War. You can't visualize the world being wiped out with muskets and bayonets. But today, there's plenty of inventory on the planet Earth to wipe out the entire planet. And that's, in fact, the triggering of that is what preoccupies most strategic decision makers. Now, the old days, you had a nuclear weapon that consisted of an essentially atomic bomb triggering a hydrogen bomb. You had a fissionable core, that is an atom-splitting type of technology in the core of it, and with shaped explosive charges, you compress that, it became an atomic bomb that would then trigger the tritium gas that made it a hydrogen bomb. And these things had a shelf life of about 7 years, as Ezekiel predicts, incidentally, in Ezekiel chapter 39. But technology has advanced. And this is something that most people are not aware of. First of all, the technology has scaled down. These things do not have to be that big, that heavy, and that expensive. They can now test the components with inert material and computer models that are valid enough to provide effective weapons due to all the testing that's going on. And many of these are available on the Internet, believe it or not. Another thing that it becomes clear if you start studying the technology and the technology of the inspectors, the UN inspectors in Iraq and the rest, is the critical skills are not the physicists. The system management skills are more critical and, interestingly enough, more available than the physicists themselves. Information access today is global. Anyone can find out anything on the planet Earth. And it's impossible to control. Critical technology would be neutron initiation, X-ray focusing, which are the most closely held ones, but all are classified programs, including our W-88 most guarded weapons programs, were compromised by the previous administration, selling the secrets for campaign financing. And so one of the great tragedies of the last decade is that the previous administration had, under that administration, they virtually were all compromised, some knowingly, some unknowingly. But there's another technology that turns out to be a stuff of legend, red mercury. Red mercury fusion technology, leading to S-megaton, as they call them, micronuclear warheads. These are softball-sized devices triggered with irradiated and compressed compound of mercury antimony oxide. It doubles the yield with about a 100-fold reduction in weight, 1/100th the size, and yet the doubling of the yield. In other words, by a highly compressed and irradiated compound of mercury, antimony, antimony oxide, it can directly trigger the tritium, the hydrogen bomb. And so you've got softball-sized micro-nukes, if you will. Now, these were first talked about in the early 90s. Even today, many people dismiss this as just rumor. But Sam Cohen, the inventor of the neutron bomb, in interviews, has come out quite candidly, saying that these things are real. You get about 2 megatons, it'll wipe out anything within about a 10-mile radius, give or take a mile or two. And they use heavy hydrogen instead of uranium. It doesn't use uranium or plutonium. And it's a handheld nuclear weapon. It cannot be detected by U.S. sensors. They were first produced in 1965 outside Moscow, and now they're built at 6 secret sites, about 150 pounds a year. This at least is the information that seems to come from reliable sources, but it's very controversial. There are some that still dismiss this as alarmism. But there are indications of certain policy moves that we're making that seems to support the fact that the people making these policies are terrified. Now, there are other Pandora's boxes in this area of weapons, not just nuclear. They're biochemical weapons. We'll talk about that in another category. But there's also this whole issue of genetics and cloning and nanotechnology that is making molecule-sized machines and robotics, making sentient machines that can do tasks. And these last three are in the process of converging. And so we're going into a world with self-replicating devices that can replicate themselves. We also are in a world where you can make directable diseases. You can create a disease that will target certain DNA groups and so forth. So there's other kinds of weapons on the horizon that sound like science fiction stuff. Let's take the next topic. That's the rise of Islam. And it's clearly the rise of Islam is the fastest growing religion on the planet Earth. And boy, what a day brings. You know, this was something that we used to be able to dismiss as the imposition of the culture of 7th century Arabia on a group of illiterate tribes in distant lands. But it's been brought to our own shores rather vividly on September 11th of the year 2001. So the towers have fallen, but have we got the message is one of the questions. Do we really understand the full significance of this? Now, some crucial questions that linger behind the Twin Tower disaster. One of them is, who could so carefully plan and efficiently execute such an incredibly inhumane destruction and slaughter of innocent people? What cause could so powerfully motivate educated and trained individuals? These aren't loonies. These are educated, trained individuals to sacrifice their own lives and the lives of so many total strangers in this manner. What cause could be so powerful? In the minds of civilized people, these men were unbelievable fanatics. But were they? If we think they were, we may have missed the point. Is this fanaticism? Could one call the spiritual leader of an entire major country a fanatic? A man universally recognized as properly representing his religion? Who could know his religion better than this spiritual leader himself? And such was Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini when he declared, quote, "The purest joy in Islam is to kill and be killed for Allah." Is this, are they fanatics who obey him today in exacting the death penalty upon Muslims, as they do in Afghanistan, Arab Emirates, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, even in the U.S., who for the sake of conscience convert to another religion? A Muslim that converts to another religion is subject to the penalty of death, usually executed by a member of his family. Are these fanatics? Who dares make the obvious connection between the declaration of war against America and the declaration of war against the entire world by Muhammad in the 7th century, which has been a part of Islam ever since? And since its inception, jihad has been waged by Islamic warriors to spread the religion of violence and hatred. Islam has always been spread by the sword from its beginning to the present day. And Islam does not change. We all saw on television the rioting Muslim mobs who invariably chant their fanaticism, "Allah is greater, Allah is greater." It isn't "Allah is great," that's a mistranslation. It's a comparative. Allah Akbar. Allah is greater. Greater than what? Fill in the blanks. Could you call the founder of a major religion a fanatic? Muhammad, who with his followers slaughtered thousands, establishing and spreading Islam. He said of Muslims, "Who relinquishes his faith, kill him." He says, "I've been ordered by Allah to fight with people till they testify there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger." This is all in the literature, well documented. You can get it in our notes. Abu Bakr, who was the first caliph to succeed Muhammad, he's one of the few whom Muhammad promised paradise without martyrdom. He's very few. Generally, the only sure way to be saved in Islam is to be killed in jihad. One of the few that was promised paradise in lieu of that was Abu Bakr. And he declared that even if he had one foot in paradise, he could not trust Allah to let him in. He says, quote, "The only sure way in Islam of achieving paradise is to sacrifice one's life in jihad." Another quote, he says, "Suicide is forbidden as self-murder, but to sacrifice one's life in killing infidels carries the highest reward." Now, we all saw the pictures on international television of the celebrations throughout the Muslim world when the towers came down. Within hours, they were celebrating their victory that these thousands of innocent people were murdered to make their point. They say Islam is a religion of peace. There are more than 100 verses in the Quran advocating the use of violence to spread Islam. There is no commandment to love anything in the Quran. In the Quran, Allah commands Muslims, "Take not the Jews and Christians as friends. Slay the idolaters," that is the non-Muslims, "wherever you find them. Fight against such as believe not in Allah." This is official Islam. It cannot change without admitting that Muhammad was a false prophet and a murderer. This is Islam we're talking. You can't win a war unless you know who the enemy is. The five myths of Islam. Islam is a religion of love, we're told on the media. Nowhere is that commanded. In contrast to that, even a Jew will admit that Jesus summarized the entire Bible quoting two verses. Deuteronomy 6:4, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy strength, and all thy mind. The great commandment. And the second commandment was in Leviticus 19:18, love your neighbor as yourself. With these two verses, Jesus summarized the entire Bible. In contrast to that, nowhere in Islam is love commanded. They say Islam is a religion of peace. That's a falsehood. It's a warrior code. It's based on a militant agenda of conquest. Always has been. Still is. There are many people that hold the misconception that Allah is simply the Arabic word for God, as equivalent to the God of the Old Testament. Wrong in both counts. It's not the word for Arabic word for God. It's the Arabic word for the God, namely the moon God, whose symbol adorns every mosque on the planet Earth. Always has, even before Muhammad. And he's not the God of the Old Testament. They're opposites. Allah is presented as capricious. He can do anything. He's unknowable. The God of the Old Testament delights in making and keeping his promises. He delights in being known. When you really look at the characteristics of both, you'll discover they're opposites. They're not the same. The Quran is a holy book. They accept Jesus as a prophet. These are all refutable myths by just doing the littlest scholarship. We have a briefing pack. On each of the trends that we're talking about, there are briefing packages, in some cases several, on the background to each of these. We can't summarize them all in this quick survey. But The Sword of Allah was published back in 1993. And some national radio broadcasts were startled because they felt that it predicted, our materials then predicted the World Trade Center thing. That's probably an exaggeration, but that's... Following. Islam is a religion of violence. Is not the attempt to force subjects into Islam the cause of cruel enslavement and torture and slaughter of millions in southern Sudan, to name one? Is not Islam the driving force behind the murderous and destructive riots against Christians in Nigeria, Indonesia, Pakistan, and elsewhere? There are thousands of being murdered, Christians being murdered, every day, some part of the world, as part of the policies and efforts of Islam. And it's not the enforcement of Islamic law that makes the Taliban and people like it deny their civil rights to those under its control, like in Afghanistan. Look at any country where Islam is the dominant force, and you'll see the results of Islam, the subjugation. Terrorists are not fanatics. They're simply devout fundamentalists who are earnestly following their religion. And this candid recognition should give us fresh sympathy for Muslims of all nationalities who are trapped, tragically, in that system. In fact, an expose of this truth should embarrass the Muslim nations into opening the Islamic curtain and allowing freedom to enter their borders. It should open a new day for evangelism, where not force, but love and reason could permit any person to determine the faith he would embrace from his own heart. That should be our goal. Now, Jihad in America. This, again, is a detailed briefing that you can, if you want to get more background here. But we'll move on to the next trend. The struggle for Jerusalem. This is a category of intelligence gathering, even among secular intelligence agencies, interestingly enough. So we'll take a look at this. The nation Israel. Boy, if you want to know what time it is on God's calendar, all you have to do is see what's going on in Israel. Because Israel's entire history is pre-written. And let me underscore something to understand what the Bible says about this. You do need to be sensitive to the fact that Israel's destiny is distinct from that of the church. They have different origins, different missions, different destinies. There are 75 references in the New Testament to national Israel in 73 different verses. And Paul, in his definitive statement of Christian doctrine called the Book of Romans, hammers away for three chapters, Romans 9, 10, and 11. Deals with Israel's past, present, and future. And of course, the book of Revelation 6 to 19 details a specific 7-year period of time that the prophet Daniel and Jeremiah and others talk much about. Now, where are they today? They're regathered, just as the Bible said they would be. Boy, one of the biggest milestones in the human history occurred on May 14th of 1948 when God regathered them in the land exactly like he said he would. In Isaiah 11, he says that when I regather them the second time, that's all there is. Now, there's an absurd prediction, it would seem, in Zechariah chapter 12, where God says, "Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about. And in that day, I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be torn in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it." Now, that may have made sense to Zechariah 2,500 years ago, but today, in today's modern world, it seems absurd. Why should this town that has no harbor, no river, no natural resource, that's not even in a strategic location anymore on critical caravan routes or what have you, there's no reason for this city to be relevant to the world, to the international community. Its only relevance is religious, and we're dealing with a world that's a-religious, it would seem. A couple trembling to all nations, not just its neighbors, ostensibly absurd, and yet it's the reality. As we're recording this discussion, the late lights are burning in every major staff group of every major capital on the planet Earth, struggling as to what posture to take regarding the city of Jerusalem. The fallacy of the peace process. You'll notice on the slide I've deliberately spelled it the way it should be spelled. P-I-E-C-E. See, the fallacy of peace process is built on a false premise. It's not the size of Israel that's the issue, it's the existence of Israel. And every step, every concession, as it were, if there were any, is simply a means to an end. They're insisting on what Israel cannot provide, namely its extermination. So this assures an armed conflict, and due to the situation, probably a preemptive nuclear strike is what it may take for Israel to survive. And if you're not familiar with the current history of Israel, modern history, since biblical times, I encourage you to acquaint yourself with that. There's a good summary we published on called Betrayal of the Chosen, where we lean heavily on A Place Among the Nations, Benjamin Netanyahu's book, the classic work by Joan Peters, From Time Immemorial, and several other of the efforts here. Now, Israel's strategic dilemma is that they've lost nuclear superiority. They've had nuclear weapons since at least 1967. I happen to know that for some reasons. And yet, it's no longer unique. They're less than 5 minutes away from a nuclear launch of their adversaries. And we've denied them conventional response. If they do get attacked, conventional means are going to be insufficient because of the reduction of their borders, and because of the armed indigenous islands of force. But the good news is that what I call the dissolving of their delusion. One of the most painful blessings in life is to dissolve our misconceptions. And even the doves in Israel are finally beginning to realize that their adversaries don't want peace. That's been a myth. And so, as we speak, there are three submarines offshore from Israel. This is a picture of the Takuma, the third of the German-built Israeli Dolphin-class submarines. There were three of them. The first two were substantially subsidized by the German parliament as reparations for the German parts that were in the Scud missiles that were used during the Persian Gulf War. But the third one, Israel paid for themselves. They took delivery on all three, and the reason they did is they're each capable of launching 8 cruise missiles with nuclear warheads. Israel has two main missiles, the Papai and the Dalila. And the Dalila is a 1,500-mile range, and these can be equipped with nuclear weapons. And so these three submarines, each with 8, is a deterrent against a direct land-based attack. And they're intended to be a deterrent. It's a very fundamental thing. But let's talk about something that we need to understand what happened on February of last year. On February 16th of the year 2001, there was a combined American and British air raid against the command and control center in Iraq, 20 miles north of Baghdad. The intention was to preempt Saddam Hussein. There were 2 U.S. AWACS, 4 Hawkeye A2C spy planes, and 36 other U.S. British aircraft took off from Interlik, our base in Turkey, and the carriers heading for Iraq. The Israeli Air Force was involved. There were 35 joint standoff weapons, JSOW weapons, the newest, best we had. 35 of these were fired. Not one of them hit their targets. They all had software problems, so they all missed. So all they really did is strengthen Saddam's resolve. Of course, you can imagine the DOD's having a tough time getting our allies interested in that. They were hoping to market some of those. A few days later, our satellites pick up 6 Iraqi divisions moving westward, including ground-to-ground missiles with launching equipment. The U.S. intelligence community estimated they would be ready for launch by Thursday evening, that very evening. Israel placed their security forces on alert. Assad of Syria was approached to get permission for those 6 Iraqi divisions to cross Syria. He gave the Hezbollah okay to unleash long-range rocket attacks against northern Israel. The U.S. and Israeli governments issued a grave warning to the Syrian government to give them pause. Palestinian sources confirmed all this. There are massive terrorist attacks being programmed, and Yasser Arafat was arranging his personal evacuation to Baghdad. A message was sent through Tony Blair to Iraq, saying essentially that neutron bombs would be used on 6 divisions that evening. There'd be both Damascus and Baghdad would be vaporized with nuclear strikes, and the button, if they didn't stand down, the button would be pushed by 7:30 that night. If you saw the movie 13 Days, which is almost a dramatized documentary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, a drama that is done quite accurately. I happened to have been with the Assistant Secretary of Defense, John Rubel, that afternoon. I had a close proximity observation of that. That movie does a pretty faithful job in general. If they were going to do a movie of February 22nd of the year 2001, you'd probably call it 13 Hours, because it was the same kind of brinksmanship involved here. Fortunately, the Iraqi surface missiles remained stationary. They all stood down, at least for the time being. But I think it's sobering for us to realize, it was in the media, but it was hushed up very quickly, but my insiders tell me we were less than 10 minutes away from a nuclear exchange on February 22nd last year. Well, there's other clouds on the horizon. Richard Holbrooke, our ambassador to the United Nations, said at the trilateral annual meeting, the resurgence of Iraq and the collapse of the Arab-Israeli peace process poses the most serious threat to world stability in nearly 4 decades. If Iraq and the Arab-Israeli conflict merge, you could have a gigantic fireball, the most serious threat to peace since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Richard Holbrooke said that at the Trilateral Commission annual meeting. He's our ambassador to the UN. Something else that's worthy of note, because we keep hearing about how we keep getting this deliberate disinformation from the press that tries to create the impression that the PLO are somehow the abused people here, that they want peace. Well, all this should have been dissolved when the Israelis intercepted a ship called Karine A. This captured ship was purchased, incidentally, in October of the year 2000, just a few months after the Camp David summit, which was supposed to promise peace here. At the same time that Arafat was pledging his first ceasefire to Ehud Barak, Bill Clinton, Hosni Mubarak, and Kofi Annan at the Sharm el-Sheikh summit. That's when they were already planning this, bought the ship and on they go. What is the Karine A? Well, it was loaded with 50 tons of rockets, Katyusha's rockets, Sagar anti-tank missiles, Dragunov sniper rifles, advanced mortars, and C4 plastic explosions. Here's a picture of the chief of staff of the IDF showing Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Defense Minister Ben Eliezer the Russian-made anti-tank Sagar missiles that were found on the Karine A. And here's some pictures of the acreage of the weapons laid out that were intercepted. The ship was funded from Iran. It was intercepted on the Red Sea. These pictures are taken in Eilat, where it was brought in and exposed to the world. And the Bush administration was made it quite clear that our own intelligence estimates there's just no doubt of the culpability on this whole thing of Yasser Arafat and the PLO. They engineered it. There's a little cartoon series in the Jerusalem papers you're probably familiar called Dry Bones. It shows Yasser Arafat saying, the only reason that Israel seized our ship with its 50 tons of weapons, ammo, explosives, landmines, and rockets is because Israel is so paranoid that they still refuse to believe that we want peace. The comic strip Dry Bones is a reason enough to subscribe to Jerusalem Post. He's very skilled. See, the world has sided with Islam in its false claim to the land of Israel, which is now inaccurately called Palestine. the promised land which was given to Israel by God of the Bible. The land does not belong to PLO. It does not belong to the UN. It belongs to God. God, the creator of the universe, has put his name on that particular piece of real estate. And we muck around with our foreign policy, we're poking our finger in the eye of God. Now, that land was occupied by Jews, continues to be the last 3,000 years, and they're the only people to have done so. And it was in recognition of that undeniable fact that all of so-called Palestine was given to the Jews for a national homeland by a 1917 ruling of the League of Nations. But steadily, the Jews were betrayed by Britain's administration of this mandate. The land was parceled out to Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and so forth. You want a Palestinian state? It's there. It's called Jordan. And by the way, the demise of the British Empire can be dated from that betrayal. Israel is now accused of occupying a land which has actually been theirs for 3,000 years. And the come lately so-called Palestinians are sustained by the world in the lie that they are the original owners of this land. It's God's land grant to Israel that is currently being challenged by the world at large. And again, I encourage you to do some background on our briefing pack, The Betrayal of the Chosen, or its equivalent, if you find it. The myths of Palestine. The Romans named the place after the Philistines in a direct attempt to banish a Jewish presence from Jerusalem. It was about the rebellion of 66 AD that led to the fall of Jerusalem. But then a few years later, in 132, we had the Bar Kokhba revolt, and the result of that was Hadrian, the emperor, decided they could never rule that unruly place as long as there was a Jewish presence. So they plowed the entire city under, renamed it after their enemies, namely the Philistines, which in Latin was Palestina. And subsequently, it was a province of the Byzantine Empire, then the Muslim empires, which were ruled from Damascus and Baghdad, never Jerusalem. Then the Crusaders, then the Mamluks from Egypt, and then the Turks from Istanbul, and finally the British Mandate. There's never been a Palestinian state, a Palestinian people, or a Palestinian language. That's a myth of the press. Well, there are three untils of Israel. The first condition for restoration is that the fullness of the Gentiles be brought in. And I believe that's a reference to the church, Romans 11:25. The second condition for restoration is that they, as a people, need to acknowledge their offense and petition the Lord's return, which they will, according to Hosea 5:15. The third condition for restoration is until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Don't confuse the times of the fullness. Times of the Gentiles is an expression of the Gentile dominion, which started with Nebuchadnezzar and concludes with the reign of the Antichrist. How long are they blinded? See, in Luke 19, when Jesus was riding that donkey, he pronounced judicial blindness on the nation. Forever? No. Paul tells us in Romans 11:25, I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. That's a term for the church. Come in where? I believe that's a reference to the harpazo, or the rapture. The prerequisite to the second coming, which is a different event, he comes back twice, once for Israel, first once for the church, then once for Israel. God says in Hosea 5:15, the last verse of that chapter, he says, I will go and return to my place, which is interesting. God returned to his place. He must have left it. I will go and return to my place until they acknowledge their offense, that's singular and specific, the rejection of the Messiah, and seek my face. In their affliction, they will seek me earnestly. And that helps explain why Satan has such an agenda to try to wipe out, not just the Jews, but the believing Jews specifically. The next Holocaust, the refuge in Edom, is a background on the whole prophetic implications of Jerusalem, the mountains of Judea, and his return as described in Isaiah 63. But let's move on to the next trend, the Magog invasion. We'll take a quick look at this. The first problem is the Magog identity. Why does the Bible use these strange names? Well, because we make it do that. We keep changing the names of things. So if you want to talk about, if you're Isaiah and you're called to talk about the Persian Empire 100 years before it surfaces in history, how do you talk about it? By its ancestors, by Elam and so forth. Well, Magog was one of the descendants of one of the sons of Noah. All the nations of the planet Earth descend from one of the three sons of Noah. Under Japheth, one of the sons was Magog, and we know a lot about him, fortunately. Hesiod, in the 8th century B.C., even before Ezekiel was describing the passages we're about to look into, he talked about the descendants of Magog. He called them the Scythians. And Herodotus, a Greek didactic, excuse me, Hesiod is a didactic poet. Herodotus is known as the father of history. He wrote in the 5th century B.C., roughly contemporary with a little with Ezekiel. He again wrote a great deal about the Scythians, using their Greek names. They dominated the southern steppes of Russia from the 10th century B.C. through about the 3rd century B.C. Very colorful, very warlike, very interesting group of people. Philo and Josephus and many of the other ancient writers talk a lot about them. In fact, the Great Wall of China was called by the ancient writers the ramparts of Gog and Magog. Now, fortunately, the Soviet archaeologists over the last 50 years have uncovered all kinds of information from the graves of the Scythians, because they're frozen. And because they're frozen, you can tell a great deal about their lifestyle. There's still material in the digestive tracts and so forth. And so we know a great deal about the lifestyle of the Scythians. Well, if you take a look at Israel, and you don't know any of the stuff we've just talked about, you do know that Magog comes from the uttermost parts of the north. All you have to do is look at a map. What's directly north of Israel? Obviously, Central Asia and Russia and so on. Now, it's interesting, Ezekiel 38 talks about an invasion, that God himself is going to intervene. It talks about Gomer and Meshech and Tubal and Togarma and Iran, or the Persians. Also put Libya and Cush and so forth. Except God himself intervenes to squelch this ill-fated invasion. That's one of the two reasons it's so well known in the Bible. It's an occasion when God himself intervenes in world history. It's yet to happen. It's never happened yet. In fact, it's interesting that in Ezekiel, Sheba and Dedan are not parties to the invasion. They're standing on the sidelines saying, hey guys, you shouldn't be doing that. How interesting. Now, there are two reasons that the invasion. The second reason is so well known, the passages, Ezekiel 38 and 39, appear to anticipate the use of nuclear weapons. The leftover weapons from this engagement will provide all the energy needs of Israel for over 7 years. And the ancient writers, the ancient commentators, assume that must be symbolic, because nothing can burn for 7 years. We smile at that today. What weapons technology could very easily provide all the energy needs of Israel for 7 years? Nuclear, of course. In fact, the passage goes on to describe how professionals are hired to clear the battlefield. They wait 7 months before entering the battlefield, then they clear it for 7 months, and they bury what they find east of the Dead Sea. Read that downwind. But the Holy Spirit isn't finished there. He had some other details in Ezekiel 39. It says, if a traveler passing through that area finds something that the professionals have missed, he doesn't touch it. He marks the location and lets the professionals deal with it. Now, those of you that have been briefed in nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare know the drill. I have here in front of me a manual, not a recent one, but it's a marking procedure for nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare. Department of the Army, TM39905001-10. And this is typical. And you guys who have been in the military know the drill. It's fascinating to find this kind of language written by Ezekiel 2,500 years ago. I believe the more you know about the passage of Ezekiel 38 and 39, and the more you know about the current situation, the more it would seem that Ezekiel 38 and 39 appears ready to happen. It could happen next week, next month, it might be some years, who knows. All the allies that Ezekiel talks about are in position today, except one. There's one country that is not in position yet, and that's Turkey. Turkey at the moment has 16 mutual assistance pacts with Israel to exchange assistance. And Ezekiel describes Meshech and Tubal, which are major cities in ancient Anatolia, Turkey, the eastern part of Turkey, Turkey is going to shift to the east. And there's a lot of evidence that it will. They've been denied their promised role with the European community, the European Union. They spent 70 years changing their alphabet, their legal structure, their entire culture to be part of the West, only to be slapped in the face. They're coming to the unavoidable conclusion that their destiny has to be with the East. So they will be shifting back in that direction. Now, when does this Magog invasion take place? Many good scholars are divided on this. The classic position is this is part of the Armageddon sequence, and that may turn out to be right. There are a number of us that hold the view, for some technical reasons, that it occurs prior to the famed 70th week of Daniel. But the main point is that the Intelligence Digest, which is arguably one of the most reputable sources of commercial geopolitical intelligence on the planet Earth for the last 60 years, has publicly indicated they believe the Kremlin has made the decision to make the invasion when they can position it strategically. So that's this is interesting, because this is not a Christian publication. It's simply a geopolitical source you'll find in any corporate boardroom that's dealing with international affairs. And, of course, there's much background here that we've just hit the highlights of and let you do some homework. And we have the Magog invasion as a briefing package. The man who would be Gog, you know, don't confuse this guy Vladimir Putin with the inebriated, backslapping Yeltsin. This guy is a cold, well-trained professional, dragged into each of his jobs throughout his whole resume because he developed a reputation for doing whatever it took to get the job done. He's your worst nightmare if you're an adversary. He's your dream leader if you're a Russian. And he's doing all the right things to clean house and to get it straightened out and to be aggressive. Keep an eye on this guy. Will he be Gog or the leader of Magog? I'm not sure. We'll watch and see. Now, those of you that have studied your prophecy, if you're serious about prophecy, of course, the place you start is the last four verses of Daniel 9. Jesus pointed to that as the key to end time prophecy. If you study that, you know that there is a climactic seven-year segment still remaining of 70 weeks of years. And 69 took place, climaxed with the triumphal entry and the presentation of Jesus the Messiah. There's an interval specified in Daniel 9, verse 25, that we've been in that's lasted almost 2,000 years. But there's a seven-year period right in front of us, called the 70th week of Daniel. The Revelation 6 through 19 is a detailing of that. The last half of that seven-year period is a period that Jesus labels the Great Tribulation. And the Old and New Testament have much to say about it. The Old Testament calls it the time of Jacob's trouble. But in any case, it ends with the second coming and the establishment of God's kingdom on the earth. The Battle of Armageddon is what is interrupted by that second coming. It climaxes at the end of that seven-year period. We know the temple will be standing by the middle of the week. We don't know when it'll be rebuilt. It could be built before the seventh week, during the first half of the week. We don't know. Many people make their little charts, but the scripture's not clear on that, except that we do know it'll be standing by the middle of the week because Jesus, Paul, and John all make reference to it. But the Magog invasion, where does it fit? The classic view is that it's part of the Armageddon scenario, and that Hal Lindsey and others, experts, may very well turn out to be correct in placing it there. There are some of us that have suspected it'll be before the 70th week, which puts us in a weird position. Because on the one hand, we think it could happen any time right now, and yet we do know it happens after the rapture. So if the Magog invasion is near, the rapture is even nearer. So that's something to think about on your way home tonight. Well, let's take one more. The rise of the European superstate. Now, to really appreciate this, we need to do a little bit of history. You may recall in Daniel chapter 2 that Nebuchadnezzar had his famous dream. We don't have time to go through the whole thing, of course, but Nebuchadnezzar did have this weird dream where he saw this metal image, head of gold, arms and chest of silver, belly and thighs of brass, and then the legs of iron. In fact, the feet were iron mixed with clay. When we get to Daniel, he sees a rock, a stone, cut without hands. It hits it in the feet, and that stone grows to be a mountain that actually fills the entire earth. Weird dream, right? That mountain, of course, is God's kingdom that he's setting up. Strange idiom. When you get to Daniel 7, we have further amplification of all this. The gold, of course, is the Babylonian Empire. Where each Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 detail four major empires between the time of their writing, that time of Babylon, and the climax of God's kingdom. The first empire is the Babylonian Empire, followed by the Persian Empire, followed by the Greek Empire, followed by Rome in its first phase. And it seems to go through a second phase, and most scholars recognize that this fourth empire is bifurcated into two halves, two phases, if you will. Well, Babylon, we know, was about 606 to 539 B.C. It was conquered by the Persians, just as the scripture predicted. The Persian Empire went from about 539 to about 332 B.C. when Alexander the Great conquered the Persians. And he and his successor generals ruled until finally conquered by the Romans. Okay, the Babylonians conquered by the Persians, Persians conquered by the Greeks conquered by the Romans. Who conquered the Romans? The answer is no one. What the scripture implies is that Rome, this fourth empire, would break into pieces. And each of these pieces would have its day in the sun, but they would finally recoalesce as a final form to be the very empire that God would intrude and intervene in setting up his own kingdom. Well, we've seen Roman Empire Phase 1. It emerged about 68 B.C. Julius Caesar was killed about 44 B.C. 31 B.C., we had the Battle of Actium. 64 A.D., that's when Nero began his persecutions. About 284 A.D., Diocletian divides the empire into two, east and west, the two legs, perhaps, some suggest. 312 A.D., Constantine moves the entire capital to the east, to Byzantium. And which becomes Constantinople, the capital of the world. But about 476 A.D., the empire is in pieces, breaking into pieces. It's on the decline. And each remaining segment has had its era. The whole history of Europe is the history of, whether it's the Dutch, the French, the Spanish, the Germans, the English, each have had their shot at it. But since World War II, something interesting is happening, especially those that have a biblical perspective. We see what some people feel is the Roman Empire Phase II. About 1951, we had the Treaty of Paris, which formed the European Coal and Steel Community, a multinational organization without precedent that was very successful at accomplishing its objectives. It became the model in 1957, March 25th, with the Treaties of Rome. I say plural because it was the European Economic Community was only one of several. There was also European Atomic Energy Community formulated then. In 1958, the next year, they formed the European Parliament. Many people, I can remember vividly giving lectures, didn't even know there was a parliament for Europe, separate from the nations. In 1959, three of the six, there were six nations that were involved so far, three of them, Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg, formed a group. But in 1967, there was a merger of the European Economic Community, the European Coal and Steel Community, and the European Atomic Energy Community. They all had commissions. Those commissions merged to form what was then called the European Community. And in 73, Denmark, Ireland, the UK joined, so the six became nine. Then Greece joined in 1981, and all the Bible buffs ran to their book. Boy, there's ten. They all thought, gee, here are the ten toes or the ten heads, what have you. They didn't read the scripture carefully. Those ten come out of the combination. They don't make up the combination. But anyway, in 86, Spain and Portugal joined. That punctured the model. Now they're 12. So everybody wondered, what does that mean? In 1990, the German unification took place. In 93, the Maastricht Treaty was signed, which replaces the Treaty of Rome. November of 1993 is a very, very key year in this whole scenario. And 2 years later, Austria, Sweden, and Finland joined, making the 15 that now make up the European Union. The EC is now properly called the EU. And we'll talk a little bit about its goals, but in the year 2000, we have the euro as its common currency. See, the Maastricht Treaty obsoleted the Treaty of Rome. It provides for a centralized European superstate with a common foreign policy, a common military, common currency, and common judicial proposals, common court. Their economic potential is larger than the U.S. The U.S. has a population base of about 270 million. Europe has 435 million. And it is an industrialized, developed country. It has a lot of overhead because of its socialism, but it potentially could be a very formidable competitor. It's interesting to see the symbol of the European Parliament, which is a woman riding a beast, and the beast is on seven hills. Whoever designed that must have had a field day pulling the chain of the biblical followers, if you know your Revelation 17 and 18. You recently saw in the news that there's steel tariff wars between the United States. They're leading to competitive isolation. Whether you're building cars in Detroit or Harley-Davidson motorcycles, you're trying to import to Europe, there's now a tariff on the steel. The free trade thing is getting clobbered. In Britain, there's an interesting decision. There's an assisted suicide decision that was before the Britain court that was forbidden by the British court. It's been appealed to the International Court. Now, what makes this case so interesting is that there's some expectation that they'll get permission from the International Court, but the main point is they're appealing it to a higher court, a court to which Britain hasn't subscribed. You see, just by the force of inertia, the International Court will be the super reigning court. Now, the European and the American media, among other things, I believe, need to be held accountable for the atrocities that are going on in the Middle East. Because the way the press is distorting the news, in Europe as well as here, as to imply some kind of equivalency between soldiers that are trying to protect its citizens and the deliberate murder of innocent civilians, to count those equivalent is just such a distortion of truth, such a biased reporting, that it should include culpability for the kind of behavior they are encouraging, especially in the European press. And there's CNN seems to have an agenda for the destruction of Israel. The disturbing thing, especially in the United States, is that the media in the United States admittedly has an agenda to shape opinion rather than to inform it. And that those scandals continue, and we don't have to take time here. Another interesting footnote to give perspective, the European Union granted 6 billion euros to the PLO. Empire Reborn is our briefing on the background here. We'll move on to the next topic. Get one more in before our break here. The rise of China. We've all seen the Chinese. By the way, that's the ramparts of Magog, Gog and Magog that you're seeing in the picture, the famed wall of China. It's interesting when you study your Bible and study the Battle of Armageddon, the climactic battle at the end of the age. It's a four-party conflict. It's initiated by the kings of the south, then responded to by the kings of the north, whoever they are. We'll leave that go for here. And then this dominant factor, this Western Confederacy moves in, headed up by a world leader that's commonly called the Antichrist. But he trembles when he discovers the kings of the East enter in. They're the climactic trump card that gets right at the climactic part. You know, you stand back from world history, it's really interesting to realize that civilizations had their cradle, their birthplace in the Mesopotamian region. But they migrate westward because the Persians ultimately give way to the Greeks and the Greeks to the Romans. And following the Roman Empire, the history of the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries is largely a history of Northern Europe. But it doesn't end there. As we get to the 20th century, the centroid of power on the planet Earth shifts where? To the United States. Henry Luce in 1941 aptly named the 20th century as the American century. Most analysts who have looked ahead feel that the 21st century is going to be the Asian century, for lots of interesting reasons. And we'll look at that in a minute, but let's remember it doesn't end there either, because it goes back to where it all started, when God interrupts the Battle of Armageddon to set up his own kingdom. China's growth rate, population about 1.3 million, about five times that of the U.S. The economy is the second largest in the world, ahead of Japan and Germany, which eclipsed in 1990. China's growing 7% faster than the United States. It accounts for 25% of all the world output, over 50% of all foreign exchange, has a very, very high savings rate. Over $50 billion a year are sent from the U.S. into China. We send them over $136 million per day. China has attracted more foreign investment capital in 5 years than Japan has in the 50 years since World War II. You sense something's going on? You bet. Richard Bernstein and Ross Monroe in their study called The Coming Conflict with China says China will soon be the world's second most powerful military giant. Marshall Pillsbury translated 600 documents by 200 different authors for the CIA and presented them before the Congress and pointed out that showed them how China is studying how to defeat the U.S. in a war they believe is inevitable. The good news is they've got a long pension span. They're planning like 20 years away, 25 years away. China presently has CSS-4s. Now, these missiles now have improved accuracy, range, and multiple warheads thanks to President Clinton's need for campaign financing, according to the Defense Intelligence Agency report. They have 18 of these, 13 of which are targeted against U.S. cities. Now, we had a former president who was proud of saying there are no missiles aimed at U.S. cities, which, first of all, was a bald-faced lie, but it also is irrelevant because with the touch of a button and the loading of some different numbers in a computer memory, you've retargeted. So how can you make those statements? But in any case, the CIA tells us 13 of the 18 are presently aimed at U.S. cities. The remaining five are at other cities, including Russia. The CIA's top secret report just recently reported to me projects over 100 of these in place by the year 2015. So there is a turbulent decade ahead. Now, China's rise to superpower status is only part of it. The retrenchment of the United States is another part of it. There are numerous causes for war in the Pacific. Many of it, unless you've studied it, you may not be familiar with it. There's a burgeoning arms race. In the Pacific, you've got all kinds of island disputes, all kinds of territorial disputes, quite apart from North and South Korea and Taiwan and all that. There's lots of others. So there's a burgeoning arms race in the Pacific, $7.3 billion of arms between China, India, Taiwan, South Korea, Pakistan, Thailand, and Vietnam. That exceeds the investment by the NATO countries. Now, why would there be war? Well, there's exploding population. 22% of the population is on 7% of the world's landmass. Their energy needs have increased 50% in this last decade alone and will continue to increase. And, of course, there's numerous islands all through Asia. And there's other disputes, of course. North and South Korea is still a tinderbox. And, of course, Taiwan. China clearly has designs on Taiwan. The book of Revelation highlights all this. In Revelation 16, verse 12, it says, "The sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water there was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared." We also find it in Isaiah 49:12. "Behold, these shall come from afar, these from the north, these from the west, and these," that is from the east, "from the land of Sinim," the very word from which China gets its root identity. The Sleeping Dragon Awakes is our briefing package if you want to get in more background here. And we will take the next series of these after a stretch break in the next session.